This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also listen to over at progressive.org. Today, my guest is Ralph Brower, author of The Strange Death of Liberal America. Ralph Brower, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Well, it's an honor to be here.
Why'd you tackle this book, this subject?
Well, the actual beginnings of it began when Paul Wellstone died in that tragic crash in Minnesota. And I was so moved by that I had to just sit down and start writing.
You're from Minnesota. Did you know Wellstone?
Yeah, I did, actually. And I knew Mary McAvoy, who was also on the plane. She worked for the College of Education, University of Minnesota. And in fact, I even knew the woman who was supposed to pick them up at the airport. So it was quite a shock.
How'd you react when you heard the news?
I was just, like a lot of people, I was just stunned. I went through all the what you go through. I mean, I cried. I threw things against the wall. But finally, for me, the way I deal with stuff like that is write. And I just sat down and started writing. And what started out as just an essay on the death of Paul and Sheila and the other people on the plane just kept getting longer and longer and longer. Back then, Paul was the deciding vote in the Senate. So his death and the fact that Norm Coleman was the winner essentially changed the whole tone of government, I think, in this country. So that was why the book got bigger than just an essay about Paul.
Did you go to that controversial memorial service for Paul?
Actually, I couldn't because of my disability, but my wife went, and they broadcast it on television in Minnesota. So I watched it on TV, and they went. And I still keep in my briefcase the program from that service. We have two of them. I have one tacked on my wall above the desk.
I mean, the idea that you can't say something political at a funeral service, a memorial service for Paul and Sheila Wellstone, it still rankles me.
Well, I was so angry by that because I sort of vaguely know the woman who started it. And I actually heard her call into the radio when I was on my way to work with the school up there. And it was clearly a setup deal. And when Rick gave his speech, we were just saying that, this is the guy that ought to replace Paul. It was a wonderful speech. And they let poor Walter Mondale, actually the chapter in the book that was cut was called The Long Night of Walter Mondale. And they just left him, I hate to use the phrase, but slowly twisting in the wind, because, that would have been a perfect chance for someone in the Democratic Party to draw a real distinction between the Democrats and the Republicans and say, is nothing sacred? Can't someone express their innermost feelings at a funeral and do that without somebody complaining that that's not right? And no one in the Democratic Party stood up for Rick. And I think that was just a terrible thing to do.
I'm speaking with Ralph Brower, author of The Strange Death of Liberal America. That strange death in the title predates the horrible accident that befell Paul and Sheila Wellstone. When did that death occur?
Well, I say that liberal America is in intensive care. And I think probably the thing to do is perhaps to start out and talk about the way I define liberal America, because there's so many definitions of it. And even worse than that, as we all know, the Republican, what I call the raucous right, has been defaming the word liberal, I think, probably for 20-some years, or maybe we could go back to Joe McCarthy. But a liberal is someone who believes that government exists to keep the playing field level. And by the playing field, I mean basically everything. And I actually divide it into what I call four cornerstones. And those are educational equity. In other words, without everybody having a fair chance at education, then you're not going to have a level playing field. Another one is media fairness. If you don't have a fair media that broadcasts the truth and allows for a variety of points of view, then you don't have a level playing field. Voting rights is the third one. If people can't vote or votes are manipulated, as we saw in Florida in 2000 and then again in 2004, you don't have a level playing field. And then last, and you know, this was Paul's Wellstone's, one of his main points is economic and social justice. If you do not allow people have a fair chance at making a living, then you don't have a level playing field.
Well, I agree that all four of those things are really important. I just have a question as to where to stop. You know, how many cornerstones, are you going to have on that building, on that edifice? And so, you know, there's questions as to whether you have, you know, non-discrimination or whether you have civil liberties as a cornerstone, or if you look at foreign policy, for instance, if you want to have a foreign policy that isn't an empire, as we are currently in and have been since World War II, then there's, you know, there's healthcare, there's the environment, there's a lot of stuff. How to limit it? How did you go about limiting that?
That was probably the hardest thing to do. No question about it. I actually am one of the things I do with my other hat is I've studied a process called system dynamics, system theory, and we've used it with schools. And so I took the idea of American democracy and I said, what if we approach democracy as a system of interrelated parts? What are the key parts of that democracy without which the democracy can't function? And, you know, healthcare was one of the main ones that we batted around literally to the last minute. And to my way of thinking, healthcare comes under economic and social justice. And as far as foreign policy goes, if we want to switch to that, I believe that the whole idea of a level playing field and those four cornerstones applies to foreign policy as well as domestic policy. And, you know, we can go back to Wilson's 14 points or FDR's Four Freedoms, the Marshall Plan. All those were, to my way of thinking, applications of that idea of the level playing field. And, of course, sooner or later we're going to get to Iraq, which I think is a classic case of not having a level playing field.
Well, how does that fit into your schema? Iraq.
Well, I think Iraq is, in terms of, if you look at the level playing field idea, yes, we can say that under Saddam Hussein, there clearly wasn't a level playing field in Iraq. But I think what we have done to the people of Iraq is to make there isn't a playing field anymore, in a way. We've made such a mess of it. We've gone from a single dictatorship to a series of sectarian groups that we can't even straighten out. And if you talk about the cornerstones, like education, we've totally wiped out their education system. They don't have any schools anymore. They don't have healthcare anymore. Those are all things we were supposed to fix, and we've just made a mess of them. And I think that more than anything else, to me, is the real tragedy of Iraq.
On these cornerstones back here in the U.S., Ralph Brower, how have they been eroded or corroded?
Oh, let's start with education, which is the area that I know best. I think you can just, for that one, just to start with, go to the No Child Left Behind Act, which I think is probably, next to the Patriot Act, the single most despicable piece of legislation that has ever been passed by this government.
I'd throw in the Military Commissions Act,
oh,
too,
yeah,
but
I'll add,
not
yeah,
to quibble.
I won't argue with that one. In fact, I guess I would put that ahead of NCLB. But in essence, NCLB says if your school If you have a school that where the teachers are teaching with textbooks that have pages missing, the bathrooms don't work, you don't have any computers at all in the school and everything else, so obviously your kids are going to have trouble performing on tests and learning. They don't have the resources. So then you say, okay, if this school without adequate resources happens to score low on a standardized test, we're going to take more resources away from them. We're not going to give them what they need. We're going to make them even worse. So that's education. The voting rights thing, I think what has happened in the last, well, let's take one example, and that is this past summer where the Republican Party essentially tried to scuttle what I think is probably one of the most significant pieces of legislation the 20th century, which was the Voting Rights Act. My son was interning in Washington at the time and happened to hear John Lewis give his just incredibly emotional and wonderful speech defending the Voting Rights Act. And
where was your son interning?
He was interning with Congress. Anyway, that is one example of voting rights. The media, we now have, you know, politicized media. Roger Ailes, who's head of the news division at Fox, has said that basically he believes it's okay for him to lean the news to the right because everybody else is leaning it to the left. Now, can you imagine if Dan Rather were to say that at CBS? We're leaning the news to the left because everybody's leaning it to the right. So that's a media fairness. And as far as the social and economic justice, there are so many books out now and so many studies done about the decline of income for pretty much everybody except the very rich in this country. In fact, the New York Times even had an article saying the not quite so very rich are now declining. So it's like everybody except the multimillionaires is declining in terms of their buying power.
And you note in your book, Ralph Brower, The Strange Death of Liberal America, that shockingly, unpardonably, infant mortality has gone up in the United States.
One of the books I'm thinking about doing next, considering the, when we were talking about the healthcare thing, we're talking about doing a book about healthcare. And what's amazing is for all the money we spend on healthcare, and I'm going to steal this from Jim Hightower, who I first heard it from, apparently this country ranks 27th in the world in terms of healthcare outcomes. And there are sections in the South, rural areas of Mississippi, inner city areas in the North, where infant mortality is actually higher than that in some countries that we consider to be, third world countries with what we would think of being a terrible healthcare systems.
Yeah, I mean, it's bad. I know in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, infant mortality is very high. So one of the things you talk about that I think is interesting in this book is how the right wing in this country and different aspects of the right wing in this country got together to really hammer at these cornerstones. Could you explain how that happened?
Yeah, I think that I call it the counter-revolution. And I think starting probably with Barry Goldwater, you see the beginnings in the Republican Party of a systematic attempt to roll back the gains of the New Deal. Now, the Republicans have always been against the New Deal, but I think with Goldwater, it really becomes organized and it becomes an ideology in a way that it wasn't before that. And then the first step in that, because there's a series of steps that took us to where we are now, was Nixon's Southern Strategy. And essentially, the Dixiecrats, Strom, Thurmond, and company, who had voted, Thurmond actually came out for Goldwater in 64, then actually began switching over to the Republican Party. Then we kind of go through the 70s, and then, of course, in the 80s, we get Ronald Reagan, who I think articulates probably better, and this is why the Republicans love him so much, is articulated the whole philosophy of the counter-revolution. When he said that the problem is government, that was it. You know, that was kind of like throwing down you know, in medieval times, throwing down the gauntlet and saying, we're going to, you know, cut government back entirely. And if we want to have a level playing field, that's not going to be government's responsibility. Then we also get the religious right joining into the coalition. So we essentially have a coalition on the right, or in the Republican Party, that's made up of Dixiecrats, fundamentalists, your what I call business Puritans, which tend to be types who are against any kind of regulation for business, and then just your old line anti-government Republican types.
Now, this anti-government philosophy that you correctly note Ronald Reagan had espoused, that really bumped against the reality of Katrina. And you talk about Katrina in your book, Ralph Brower. The book's called The Strange Death of Liberal America. Explain why you think that exposed that philosophy as bankrupt.
I think Katrina is probably the single most despicable domestic event that has happened in this country in a long, long time. I start the book out, actually, because a lot of people seem to think that the idea of government helping people started with the New Deal, and it didn't. And so the first chapter in the book actually talks about attempts that local governments were making as far back as the early 1900s to help people. And there's actually a wonderful book by a guy named Tom Cranes that's all about some counties in Colorado that were lending help to people. And so there were 3,000 people in one county that they were giving money to because a widow had had her husband die in a mining accident or something like that. So here, almost 100 years later, we have Katrina. And we have, all of us experienced that, the just utter frustration. And there were times where I had literally had tears in my eyes because to see what was happening and to see those people standing on bridges and some of them trying to swim through the water to get to freedom, and us doing nothing to help them. When these people in Colorado 100 years ago could help out all the people in Colorado, it's just amazing. I use the quote in there about Katrina because we talk about, well, we can't help out all those people. There were too many of them. There were hundreds of thousands. And so I went back to the New Deal, and I was researching Harry Hopkins and some of the things that they'd done to the New Deal. And when you put down what Harry Hopkins did in the first days of his administration of the WPA, they were putting 500,000 people to work in one day. Now, if we can do that in the 1930s, when we did not have the money that we have now, when we didn't have the domestic resources that we do now, we didn't even have the technology that we do now, and we can't do that for the people of New Orleans, and a year from now, we still have 100,000 people without homes, is that is as big a black mark on America as I can think of.
It's a huge indictment. My son actually was just down there for 2 weeks doing demolition work and helping out doing some volunteering, and the images he's brought back are still shocking. And I do, like you, remember the shock of just sitting there watching CNN and saying, why, and my wife screaming, why can't, you know, people get them some help?
Yeah, so when I watched it on CNN, even Aaron Brown, you know, was saying that one night. I don't remember who he was interviewing from FEMA, but he finally got so angry, he turned to the guy and said, don't you people get it?
It might have been Mike Brown, for all we know.
Yeah.
So another section, maybe that some people are just ensconced in their little suburbs, though. And you talk a lot about what you call the suburban uprising. And what is the suburban uprising?
Well, starting with the formation of the suburbs after World War II, which on the surface was it a good idea. You know, we had all these veterans returning. They didn't have housing. And I think we owed those veterans something for the service that they did during World War II. And so we made it easy for them to get home loans. And we, the, you know, starting with Levittown and some of the other suburbs in New York, builders were starting to figure out how to build housing more cheaply than they had done before. And so we were able to build these communities that, you know, could house people at what had been relatively high costs and now were low costs. The dark side of that is that most of the suburbs that were built were essentially redlined. And so if you were a person of color, you could not get a house in the suburbs. And so the way that plays out in terms of the whole theme of the strange death of liberal America is that you have these all-white enclaves forming around the inner city at the same time that you have the Dixiecrats and the Southern strategy and, you know, the civil rights movement going on and people saying, you know, the civil rights movement's a bad thing and so on and so forth. So suddenly, you have these segregated areas in the North.
Even some of those segregated areas in the North now, Ralph Brower, are becoming more impoverished. There was a statistic recently that said poverty is growing in the suburbs as well. Do you think that's going to help fuel a movement back toward this liberal society that you hope for?
I think it will. Let me give you three reasons why I think that might happen. First, I think is the one that you cited. Every indicator, economic indicator we have shows the middle class is falling behind. In fact, one of the most fascinating pieces I saw was, you know, Brooks, I'm blanking about
David Brooks.
Yeah, had written this piece about, no, it's not really happening in the New York Times. And right above him, they had this big chart that was showing all these economic statistics. And the chart was showing that, Mr. Brooks, you're wrong. It is happening to the middle class. So the economic troubles the middle class is running into is going to be one issue. Second is now because of the civil rights movement and because of efforts by people of color themselves to say, we've had enough of this, we're not going to have this redlining happening anymore, you're seeing more and more suburbs become multicultural communities. And I think that is a wonderful thing for America, and I hope that that will continue. And then, the third one is that people don't talk about a lot, but I think maybe the linchpin in all this is education. A lot of suburban school districts are in deep trouble, and that is because of the Bush administration, initially the Reagan administration, cutting back on funds to the states. The states then cutting back on funds to local school districts, and now we have school districts in trouble.
To me, what that means is that those who can afford it will be sending their kids more and more to private high schools or middle schools or even elementary schools, and there'll be a brain drain in part and a resource drain from the public schools, and the public schools will continue to go down. They won't be able to meet the standards of No Child Left Behind. They'll get suffocated from additional funding, and things will just slide further and further down. What's to stop that from happening?
You sound like a Republican to me there. I mean, that's the plan, I think. I think you've outlined it quite well. That's what's behind No Child Left Behind. I think the Republicans are out to starve public education to the point of which vouchers, which has always been their big cause, becomes viable. We know that vouchers, Katrina and New Orleans are an interesting case of this, because in New Orleans, they essentially, before Katrina, they had basically a dual school system. And the rich white folks went to private schools. The average tuition, as I remember, now don't quote me on this, but it was something like $10,000. And that they had this loan shark business going in Louisiana, where if you wanted your child to go to one of these rich private schools, you'd take out a loan, and the loans ranged anywhere from 10% to 20%. So all we have to do is extrapolate that out to every other city in the United States and say, who's going to afford these private schools? It's not going to be me or you. It's going to be the rich people. Hmm.
My guest today is Ralph Brower, author of The Strange Death of Liberal America. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at The Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. You talk intermittently in this book about the failure of the Democratic Party. Tell me where you think it's gone wrong.
I talk in the – there's one of my favorite paragraphs in there says essentially the Democratic Party lost its moral compass. And by that I mean I think the Democratic Party no longer stands for anything. If you were to grab anybody off the street and say, what does the Democratic Party stand for? What are its values? I don't think you could get a straight answer. I'll bet you could go to a Democratic gathering. You know, let's say this month there's a local party caucus or a Senate district meeting or whatever, and ask the people at that meeting what the Democratic Party stands for. And I think you'd get 10 or 15 different answers.
Your friend Paul Wellstone used to say he represented the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party.
Paul stood for something, and I think that is the difference. And Paul made no bones about what he stood for, and he was never going to compromise on what he thought were the most important principles. Paul stood up for against the Iraq War long before most people even thought it was an issue. Paul stood against the bankruptcy bill. So you bet, if you've got values and you follow those consistently, then I think you'll have a party again.
In that same paragraph, I think, where you mentioned the loss of the moral compass, you said the Democrats had poked themselves in the eyes.
Oh, yes.
How did they do that?
I think that as much as I like, there are parts about Bill Clinton that I like and things that he did that I think were good. I think this notion that we all know about, this triangulation thing, where you try to somehow steer course between the left and the right was a huge mistake. Number one, it's not an ideology. It's not a set of values. It's just a tactic. So what does the party stand for other than a tactic? Again, my friend Jim Hightower put this pretty well when he wrote a book that says the only thing in the middle of the road are yellow lines and dead armadillos. And
we don't get those up here in Wisconsin.
No, I know. What do we get? Dead
raccoons, possums.
Yeah. Anyway, I wrote another one that said that the Democratic Party is like a drunk trying to walk down the middle of the road and not fall down. You can't do that. You have to stand for something eventually.
Ralph Brower, we only have about a minute left. You say there are some signs of a more humane and optimistic America that give you hope. What are a couple of those?
Well, I think Katrina is one. It was amazing that when the government wouldn't help, what people did for themselves. And there are just, literally hundreds of stories of what people did during that event that were helping each other out. The other thing I think is that you're beginning to see people getting tired of the Democrats not having any values, and I think you're seeing people getting tired of this lack of a level playing field. People are feeling it, personally now, and I think they're getting angry. I liken it to a pot with a lid on it, and it's boiling underneath, and eventually the lid's going to come off.
Well, I'm waiting for it to boil over. Ralph Brower, thanks so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Well, thank you for having me. It was wonderful.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.